Well, I mentioned last Sunday evening that we're only going to proceed for now to the end of Proverbs chapter 9. We'll then take a break and, God willing, return to Proverbs 10 in a little while. So this evening then is our last study for just now in this book. And so we're looking at Proverbs chapter 9. Verses 1 to 18, and as we consider this passage for a few moments, then I'd like us to do so under two headings, looking first of all at contrasting appeals. Now, I hope you're not fed up by now of me talking about structure. I somewhat went to town on this at the start of this morning's sermon, but of course, as responsible Bible students, it is one of the first questions we should be asking about any passage that we're considering. How is this passage built? How is this passage structured? And that then is a valid question as we come to Proverbs chapter 9. And in this passage then we have a beginning section, verses 1 to 6, and a concluding section, verses 13 to 18, both of which are dominated by what I've called appeals. There's obviously a middle section, verses 7 to 12, which we'll come to in the second part of our sermon, but there are these opening and concluding sections, both of which are dominated by appeals. And there is, as you perhaps have noticed as I read, there is some verbal commonality between the two appeals, the appeal in the opening section and the appeal in the closing section. So verses 4 and 16 are identical. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. So, and to him who lacks sense, she says, dot, dot, dot. So there's some verbal commonality, but that cannot disguise the fact that these two appeals are in fact very contrasting indeed. And so let's ask two questions then in this connection. So question number one, who are making then these appeals? Who are making these appeals? Well, in the first case, in verses 1 to 6, it's wisdom who is making the appeal. And we're familiar with this from last week and from earlier passages also. Remember, we talked about this literary device called personification. And that then is dominant throughout Proverbs chapter 8. And it's continued now into chapter 9. Here again, in these opening verses, we have wisdom. Which, of course, isn't a person. Wisdom is an inanimate entity. It's an abstract concept. But here we have wisdom being treated as a person, wisdom being personified and making this appeal. And you'll notice then in verse 3 that we have wisdom sending out these spokespersons. And this is probably a reference then to those in the Israelite community who were responsible for imparting wisdom, who were responsible for imparting God's commandments, especially parents, because of course that's a very common theme, isn't it, in the book of Proverbs, the father instructing his son. So the parent was a very important imparter of wisdom within the Israelite community. But then there were others. There were priests who had a teaching role. There were scribes like Ezra who clearly had a teaching role. And so these spokespersons sent sent out by wisdom. They are the ones who teach the Torah, teach the law of God, impart God's commands. Of course, those examples I've just mentioned, fathers and priests and scribes, are not actually young women, as we have in verse 3, but that just fits with the picture that's been painted here of wisdom as a nobleman. Preparing a feast and then inviting guests, and the nobleman then would have sent out his servants to invite the guests, and those servants would often have been the girls, the young women on the estates. And so that's why these spokespersons, although actually fathers and priests and scribes, they are portrayed as young women. And so it's as if then wisdom here is appealing, urging herself on the people of God, on the Israelites, and doing so through these spokespersons. So in the first case then, who's making the appeal in verses 1 to 6? It's wisdom. What about in the second case, in verses 13 to 18, at the end of the chapter? Well, there you'll notice then, it's the woman folly. That's how this appealer is introduced in verse 13. Now, it would be tempting then perhaps to think that what we have here is a corresponding personification. Now, instead of wisdom being personified, folly being personified. I think actually what we have here is the opposite of personification. What we have here is actually depersonalization. Let me explain what I mean by that. Let's look at a few of the things we're told about this woman folly there in that paragraph. We're told that she's loud, verse 13. We're told that she knows nothing, verse 13. We're told that she targets those who pass by, verse 15. We're told that she advocates stolen water, verse 17. And we're told that she has a house which kind of merges with Sheol, the underworld, the place of the dead, the grave, verse 18. Now, do those details I've just gone through there, do they sound familiar? They should sound familiar. Because we've had precisely those details ascribed to the loose woman in these early chapters of Proverbs, the adulteress, the woman who's married but is nonetheless a loose woman who goes around trying to seduce young men, who entices and allures, particularly in chapter 7, but also in chapters 5 and 6, also a little bit in chapter 2. You remember that character, she's been very prominent. And so she was loud, chapter 7, verse 11. She's described there as loud. She knows nothing, chapter 5, verse 6. That language, that terminology is used of her. She targets those who pass by, chapter 7, verse 8. She targets that young man who is passing along the street near her corner. And it's the same verb that we have here now in chapter 9, 15. She, too, advocates stolen water. Now remember from chapter 5, verses 15 to 18, remember that metaphor of water. And remember how water there in chapter 5, verses 15 to 18, it stands then for your source of sexual satisfaction. And the point there then is that in trying to seduce men, this loose woman is really trying to get them to look beyond their own fountain, their marriage partner, their legitimate source of sexual satisfaction, and trying to get them to steal water from elsewhere, from outside of their own fountain, their own cistern, their own well. And then she has a house, doesn't she, that merges with Sheol, chapter 7, verse 27, that's made explicit there. So, you see then that this woman folly in verses 13 to 18 of our chapter this evening, it's actually the adulteress, the loose woman we've encountered several times already in Proverbs. And this is the thing, you see. As she, in those earlier chapters, as she engaged in her seductions, she very much tried to present herself, didn't she, as a genuine person. It came across particularly in chapter 7. A person of religious depth. Remember how in chapter 7 she claimed to the young man she's trying to seduce, chapter 7 verse 14, I have been and offered sacrifices today. I'm a pious woman. She's a woman of religious depth and of exquisite taste. She talks about her couch and her bed, verses 16 and 17, with all these fancy linens and fancy perfumes and spices. So she very much tries to present herself as a genuine person, offering, therefore, to this young man that she's seducing a genuine relationship of love and intimacy and exclusiveness. And you see, it's as if our passage now, this last paragraph of chapter 9, it's saying, look, don't believe it for one moment. It's saying, if you get into bed with her, you're not getting into bed with a person, you're getting into bed with folly. You're dealing with sheer foolishness here, dressed up as an attractive and desirable woman. And so you see why I say then it's kind of the opposite of personification. On the one hand, we have wisdom that isn't a person being treated as a person. On the other hand, we have the adulteress who is a person, but being stripped by the author of Proverbs of her personality and presented as sheer folly, actually, sheer foolishness. That's ultimately what she is. So that was our first question. Who are making these appeals, these contrasting appeals? Well, it's wisdom on the one hand then, and it's folly, woman folly on the other hand. But then question number two, how are they contrasting then? How do these two appeals that they make, how do they contrast? Well, obviously, they contrast in the sense then that woman folly is urging people to engage in illicit sexual activity, stolen water. As I said, that's a metaphor for illicit sexual activity. Whereas wisdom, of course, is urging people to pursue purity. Because remember, we've said again and again, and we said particularly last week, that the content of wisdom is the law of God, God's commandments, including then the seventh commandment about sexual purity. So there's that obvious contrast then between the two appeals, folly, encouraging people to engage in illicit sexual activity, wisdom, encouraging purity. But we can say a little bit more than that. I want to particularly focus for a moment on the opening verse of the chapter. I think it's significant that whereas folly in verse 14 sits at the door of her house, we are told, wisdom in the opening verse, wisdom has built her house. And there's an emphasis, isn't there, on the strength of this edifice, this house that wisdom has built. She has hewn or dug her seven pillars. Now, a house in those days with seven pillars, that would have been an immensely strong structure. And I think it's suggesting then that in contrast to folly's appeal, which is flimsy, there's something robust and strong about wisdom's appeal. Folly's appeal to just engage in sexual immorality is flimsy, Wisdom's appeal for purity is robust. And perhaps we can identify two ways in which it is so. First of all, it's intellectually robust. It's intellectually robust. The appeal then of wisdom to be pure. It's, to use the language, the imagery of this verse, it's hewn, it's dug into some very deep undergirding philosophical foundations. It's based on these rock-solid foundations that there is a God. And that God then is in his character faithful and covenant-keeping. And that God knows best what is needed for the healthy functioning and for the happiness of his creatures. And that God has written a law which includes in it then the seventh commandment about purity. And that law is for the good of his creatures. Wisdom's appeal is based on all of that, that whole framework, beginning with a creator and a creator who is good and faithful in his character and who has written a law. The appeal for purity is well grounded in those great theological truths. By contrast, look at folly's appeal. Just engage in sexual immorality. What's its basis? What's it based on? What's it grounded in? Well, look at the argument. The sole argument that she uses in verse 17. Stolen water is sweet. In other words, it's the stolenness. It's the illegitimacy of this sexual activity that makes it so exciting. And that's all the argument. That's all the reasoning she has. I mean, it's pathetically childish, isn't it? You know, if we hand out sweets to our three children, then we expect Fraser to find Isaac and Talitha's sweets more attractive and desirable than his own, because he's three. And yet here you see that this kind of three-year-old logic represents the entire intellectual basis of woman folly's appeal. This water is stolen, therefore it's sweet. There's something exciting about it because it's forbidden, because it's illegitimate. And don't we see that in our society today? The lifestyle magazines in the newsagents, the agony aunt columns in the tabloids, the relationship gurus on daytime television, they all encourage then all kinds of immoral behaviors on the basis of, if it feels good, do it. It's your body. Pursue the best possible sexual experiences at all costs. It's fun to experiment. And so we could go on with similar slogans and sound bites. Marriages are being broken, innocent children irreparably hurt, pregnancies terminated, sexually transmitted infections spread, the whole dignity and sanctity of human sexuality being trodden into the mud, and driving the whole fiasco is this intellectually bankrupt basis, just these silly, flimsy slogans and ideas. If it feels good, then go for it, that kind of thing. And that's what's going on here in our chapter. Folly's appeal, stolen water is sweet. It's just so stupid. And so, this evening, we must make sure we don't fall for it. Perhaps you're a young person, particularly exposed to folly's appeal in the magazines, on the films, and all the different media of our society, constantly bombarded with this appeal, just go for it, just enjoy sexual immorality. Don't fall for it, I'm saying. Listen rather to the appeal of wisdom that is grounded, that has an intellectual basis, that is hewn into the rock of God's reality and God's truth and God's revelation, that is based on deep, eternal truths. It's intellectually robust. But then secondly, wisdom's appeal is eternally robust. It's eternally robust. When you're at Bible college and you're in classes about preaching, they'll always encourage you not to be too shouty in your preaching. And they'll tell you the story then of the preacher who had it scribbled on the side of his notes at one point: weak point, shout louder. The point being then that volume is supposed to make up for the flimsiness of the content at that particular point in the sermon. And I guess that's how it works in our society, isn't it? As we've just said, stolen water is sweet. That's the sole argument, really, for the epidemic of sexual immorality in our society today. And it's a stupid and flimsy argument. And so what does society do? It just shouts it as loud as it possibly can. And it makes it then, it fills then with that message our blockbuster films and our chart-topping pop songs. And it just bombards people with that message. It has no basis, and so to compensate for that, it shouts it as loud as it possibly can. And it works then. And to many people, the philosophy stolen water is sweet. It seems plausible and it seems fine and it seems credible. But it won't always do so. Remember back in chapter 1, verse 27, we had the language there of a calamity, a whirlwind, a storm that is coming. And back then when I preached on that, I said that is likely a reference ultimately to the final storm, the storm of the day of judgment. And you see, when that comes, when the storm of God's judgment comes, then folly's appeal in all its flimsiness, all its stupidity, stolen water is sweet, it will crumble. It might look very rock solid now in our society because it shouted so loud, but on that day it will crumble. And all who have swallowed it and all who have lived their lives by it will crumble with it. But you see, wisdom's appeal: be pure, live pure lives, holy lives, sexually pure existences. It won't crumble. It has these seven pillars. It's strong, it's robust, it's structurally sound. It will emerge from the devastation of that storm intact, fully intact, and along with it all those who have lived on that basis. So again, I urge you, as someone perhaps this evening and very much exposed in our society to folly's appeal, folly's urgings, just go for it. Just go where your desires take you. I urge you instead to listen to wisdom's appeal: be pure. Be pure. It's not only intellectually robust, it's eternally robust. Wisdom's appeal, unlike folly's, will survive the storm of that coming day. So we've seen then these contrasting appeals: the appeal of folly and the appeal of wisdom. But then secondly, notice contrasting attitudes. had contrasting appeals, secondly, contrasting attitudes. And so, just for the last few minutes then, let's turn our attention to the middle part of Proverbs 9, verses 7 to 12. Where then we have exhibited these contrasting attitudes to which my heading refers. And I'm talking then about two contrasting attitudes to wisdom's appeal. Remember, wisdom's appeal here in Proverbs 9 is purity. Live purely. And here in the middle section of the chapter, we have two contrasting attitudes to wisdom and her appeal. And so, on the one hand, we have some who hate it. Don't reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. And so this is the reproof of wisdom. Coming through wisdom spokespersons that we've already mentioned. And this is saying then that there are some people, and when they hear wisdom's appeal about living pure lives, they will hate that. Absolutely hate it. In fact, they will hate it so much, verse 7, the spokesperson will be at risk of being injured by the audience. He who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. So there are some who will even try to injure the person who's imparting wisdom to them. So that's one attitude provoked by wisdom's appeal, just hatred, hostility, antagonism. Real, intense loathing. But then we have another attitude, don't we? There are others who love wisdom's appeal. So reprove a wise man, the end of verse 8, and he will love you. So pass on the same wisdom, the same commands of God, the same seventh commandment about purity. And there are some who will love that and embrace it and think it's beautiful and compelling. And so there are these then polarized responses to wisdom's appeal. And this fits with our experience, doesn't it? And so we are, most of us tonight, Christians, and we know lots of Christians, and all of us then, we find God's law, we find it beautiful, and we find it so compelling and so magnetic and so attractive. And so lovely. And yet we know many, many more people. We know so many people in our society who find it vile, find God's law, God's wisdom, who find God's sexual ethics vile, hateful, loathsome. And it does seem to be that often that polarization, doesn't it? Which is strange. So Hannah then isn't massively into football, but there are times when she'll watch a game, perhaps it's a big game, a World Cup game or something, and she'll get quite into it. Why can't it be like that with people's attitude to God's wisdom, God's commands? Okay, they might not be that into them generally, but why can't they at least have fleeting affection for and interest in them? Why is there just, it seems, often this total polarization? You either love God's commands or you hate them. Well, verse 10 explains why. And it explains it in now familiar terms, having gone through these first nine chapters of Proverbs. And the terms are these: that biblical wisdom only becomes cogent. It only makes sense once you're fearing the Lord. If you're not fearing the Lord, then inevitably it will seem provocative, confrontational, unattractive. If you're not fearing the Lord, you won't like the seventh commandment or any of the other nine. They all only fall into place once you're fearing the Lord. Now, I said that verse 10 explains this in now familiar terms, but actually, although The first half of verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, although that's familiar to us now. The second half of verse 10 has an addition, doesn't it? And it's a very valuable and helpful addition. It further defines for us what we mean by the fear of the Lord. And this is important because I think we struggle with that sometimes. And this whole idea of fearing the Lord, which is so prominent in the Old Testament and portrayed so positively in the Old Testament, we struggle a bit with that. Why is it so good to be fearing the Lord? What does that mean exactly? But here, very helpfully, fearing the Lord is further defined in the second half of verse 10 as knowing the Lord, the knowledge of the Holy One. And you all know, I'm sure, that that word knowledge in the Old Testament, when used of a relationship between two persons, it's a very strong term. Knowledge is used of the most intimate relationship between human beings, of the sexual relationship between a man and wife. Adam knew his wife Eve, and so on. And here then, knowledge of the Holy One, it's not just knowing some theology. It's not just knowing who God is, it's knowing God. It's knowing Him lovingly. It's being in a relationship with Him. It's knowing Him deeply and intimately. And of course, that only happens through the Lord Jesus Christ, doesn't it? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. No one knows God in that sense. People know about God, perhaps, but nobody knows God. Nobody's in a relationship with God except through me. And verse 10 is saying then that that is the necessary prerequisite for enjoying and finding attractive God's commands. If you don't know God through Jesus Christ, then biblical wisdom, all the commands, they will just seem unattractive. They will seem provocative and confrontational. But when you're in a relationship with God through Jesus, when you know God, and you know that all your breaking of God's commandments has been paid for by Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, then you just want to obey these commandments and you want to incorporate them into your life. And so I just want to close this evening, and I think it's a fitting close to these first 9 chapters of Proverbs, by asking you that question. Are you in the category of verse 8, the second half of the verse, that when you hear wisdom imparted to you by your parents, if you're a young person tonight, by the men who stand behind this lectern and preach, when you're just reading the Bible for yourself, when you're exposed to the commandments of God, do you love them? Or do they rile you? Do they irritate you? Do they leave you cold? And if the latter, the answer isn't to memorize them better. The answer isn't to read a book about God's law, to read a book about wisdom. The answer is to come through Jesus Christ into a relationship with God. And you can do that tonight. And then suddenly, you will find yourself wanting His law, wanting wisdom, and finding wisdom the most attractive lifestyle imaginable. May that be true of all of us. Amen. Well, our final hymn this evening is number 79, The Day Thou Gave.